Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good morning, afternoon, whatever it is. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Spot for this Monday, August 6th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med. Saratoga Hospital, with more than 20 locations across the greater Saratoga region. People you trust, care you deserve. SaratogaHospital.org. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Jillian Wolf of Albany Medical Center. She's a fellowship-trained urologic surgeon who provides both care to men and women. She specializes in providing care to patients with conditions that include incontinence and overactive bladder. Got a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in now. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Don't be embarrassed. We all have these problems. Dr. Wolf and your calls all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on the Medical Monday to discuss urology is Dr. Jillian Wolf of Albany Medical Center. She's a fellowship-trained urologic surgeon who provides care to both men and women. Dr. Wolf specializes in providing care to patients with conditions that include incontinence, overactive bladder, pelvic prolapse, and neurogenic bladder. I don't even know what that is. She also provides medical management to patients for a broad range of urologic diseases and disorders through medicinal therapy and physical therapy. All right, I'm going to buy onto that. Dr. Wolf, what is neurogenic bladder?
Hi, and thanks for having me on. So neurogenic bladder, you know, not a lot of people talk about incontinence and problems with their bladders, but people who do have neurologic issues such as MS or spinal cord issues have problems with their bladders as well. And it can run the gamut. It can be from leakage of urine or difficulty emptying. And part of my job is to help figure out exactly what's going on and help them manage it.
Now, I do want to talk to you a little bit before we begin taking calls, and there are some on. The number is 1-800-348-2551. I do want to talk to you about prolapse. What's a prolapse?
So prolapse is a condition where you have weakness in the muscles or the ligaments that hold up the pelvic organs. And what results from this is that you have a protrusion of those organs through the vagina, whether it be the bladder, the rectum, the cervix, or the top of the vagina in a woman who's had a hysterectomy. And can cause a variety of symptoms. It can be anywhere from asymptomatic, or it can cause just a feeling of a bulge, pressure, incontinence, or difficulty emptying the bladder or having a bowel movement.
So what are some of those organs that fall down through the vagina?
So mainly it would be the bladder. It would be the uterus and cervix, or the top of the vagina, or it could be the rectum. And sometimes you can actually have some small bowel coming through there as well. And it differs in every patient.
And is this something that you particularly specialize in?
It is. It's something that I have an interest in and that I do surgery for, and also non-surgical treatments for. And do things from just observation. Physical therapy is good for some patients. There are non-surgical treatments such as pessaries, which are silicone devices that we fit to help hold up those bulging organs.
Well, weren't pessaries used as birth control for a while back in the day?
I don't know if they're so much used as birth control. It's possible, but they are one of the oldest forms of
medical. When I say
like,
back
medical,
in the day, I mean
like
back
Egyptians.
In the day.
Yeah, they were there. There's evidence that the Egyptians had pessaries. I mean, we've refined them somewhat since then, but
yeah. So this prolapse thing of yours is important to you, but everybody's listening wants to know. Okay, you're a urologic surgeon, so come on, do you work on men also, and how does that work? We've always wondered about gynecologists male gynecologists, but you're a female urologic surgeon. Do men get embarrassed with you?
I assume that probably some do. I think you have to build up a therapeutic relationship between any of your patients. especially when it's a delicate topic that urologists see.
Well, nurses have been putting catheters in men's penises for years.
That's
right?
True. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it's just a matter of attitude.
I guess you're right.
You're terrific. Okay, let's go. Can we take a call?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, great. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Most urinary tract infections are still caused by gram-negative organisms.
They are. The majority of urinary tract infections are still caused by gram-negative organisms, which are organisms that you tend to see spread from the rectal compartment, so things like E. coli or Klebsiella. It's where you tend to see the gram-negative organisms.
What's an organism?
So the bacteria. It's just a way that you classify the bacteria. It's based upon just different types of dyes that you use and look at the bacteria under the microscope. But, we still see a lot of gram-negative organisms. You see some gram-positive every once in a while. But still, they tend to come from the same place. And sometimes we see mycoplasma more and more, too, which kind of fall into neither of the categories.
And how do those bacteria get in there?
Most commonly, they crawl, you have some fecal soiling anywhere around, and it tends to go retrograde up the urethra into the bladder.
Uh-huh. Now, the urethra is a very important part of all of this, isn't it?
It is.
Where does it go from to?
So it goes from the bladder to the outside world. It's the tube that we urinate through.
Right. Is there a difference between a man's urethra and a woman's?
There are many differences. Men tend to have longer urethras, which is one of the reasons that women tend to get more urinary tract infections, because the bacteria have a shorter distance to go. And then there are just some differences in terms of some of the muscle structures and the sphincters between men and women, but the cells and everything that line them are similar, yes.
Now, I'm sorry, I'm reaching way back into my memory, but isn't one of the things that happens is that the urethra gets compromised somehow by something that goes around it, or it goes around?
Are you asking me about the prostate?
Yeah.
Men have prostates and women don't. Yes.
Yeah, and the urethra and the prostate, can the urethra compromise the prostate and give you prostatitis or something like that?
I mean, you definitely can get bacterial infections from the urethra and the prostate. Prostatitis is, a complicated topic, but you can get bacterial urethritis from the urethra. It tends to be more the other way, where the prostate itself grows over time, and in men, it starts to grow into the urethra, making it more difficult to empty the bladder.
That's, I think, what I was talking about. Jim, thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Ryan in Orange County. Ryan in Orange County, here you go. You're on.
Hi, Dr. Wolf. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
So here's kind of what I have going on. I'm 36 years old, and I've produced many really small kidney stones, very small, like sand to dust. And over time, what I've noticed, a couple times every month, I'll get really intense back pain or flank pain or abdomen pain, and I generally feel pretty lousy. And then I'll go to urinate, and I'll have this really what I would describe as like a chalky urination, where it feels like there's sediment in there, or it's very, very cloudy. And I would describe the appearance as chalky. Burns like heck coming out, and then I start to feel a little bit better. This has been going on for like 10 years. I've had a couple UTIs, I think, because of this, because of like the scratching or the inflammation. I also have chronic prostatitis, which this chalky urine kind of predates all of that. I've been to a number of urologists, and they tell me to drink plenty of water, which I do, but I haven't been able to get any other information yet. And I was curious if that's something you heard of, or any suggestions you might have.
Yeah, I mean, kidney stones are common. Definitely. You're on the right track with drinking lots of water. I always I like to liken it to, you think about a sugar cube. You put a sugar cube in like a shot glass of water and it tends to clump together. Or you put in a big glass of water and it just dissolves. So think about just trying to dilute your urine. You want to be the type of person who's having, the clear looking urine as opposed to yellow urine. And then there are other things.
Yeah.
There are dietary changes too. Probably the most important thing would be to actually decrease your salt intake. Most people think kidney stones, they're made out of calcium. I should try and limit your calcium. But that's actually Not true. You should have just a normal amount of calcium in your diet. It's really sort of in the microscopic workings of your kidney. It's actually the salt ions that regulate how much of the calcium gets into your urine. So if you try and cut down on salt, either, and it's not just like table salt, it's processed foods, restaurant foods, and salt can really hide in a lot of things. That's another big one.
Yeah, certainly. I've actually done a pretty intensive diet overhaul, you know, just to like try to get as much water in as I can. And I'm getting upwards of like 100 ounces a day, you know, so the urine is always, you know, it's always clear. Plenty of exercise. You know, I've discovered like the oxalates. I've tried to cut back on them. Dramatically reduced salt and processed food. I was curious, like that real chalky urine or like that sediment. Do you think that's kidney stone, or do you think it's something else? And the reason I ask is because I've had it actually sampled a couple of times where I give a urine sample. You can see like this it looks like I don't know how to describe it. It's like white flaky stuff. And then the doctor looks at it and says, oh, yeah, good, I'm glad you caught this. They send it away for analysis, and then, you know, they say, well, it comes back perfectly clean. You know, so I don't know if this is, like, some kind of, like, deeper infection or if this could be the prostatitis or exactly what it could be.
I'm not really sure. I would probably have to take a look at it itself. But, you know, it can come anywhere from the kidneys to the bladder if you're not emptying your bladder all the way. You know, there are a variety of things that it could be.
Hey, listen, Ryan, I'm so sorry. We got to take a break. It's mandated. And we thank you for your call. Very interesting. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. And we are back. We're having a great time here with Dr. Jillian Wolf. And I'm probably mispronouncing. Is it Gillian or Jillian?
Oh, it's a soft G. It's Jillian. You had it correct.
Oh, good. I should have shut up. So it's great to talk to you. We've got a lot of people on the phone. Let's go to, Jeff in Schenectady, who's been patiently holding on. All right, Jeff, you're on.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about my son, and just to give a really quick medical history of him, he has he's bipolar autistic, and he has a rare genetic condition called PPK. And he's 18, and we're still dealing with incontinence at night. And we've seen urologists several times, but we really haven't gotten anywhere other than just a prescription for, like, desmopressin. Any direction for, you know, improving the situation would be very helpful.
Now, that incontinence at night, especially people with autism or different types of disorders, is probably one of the more difficult types of incontinence to manage. But I would say that probably making sure that all of the daily things are doing well. Sometimes if you train your bladder the best during the day, it can be a little bit better at night. You know, just making sure to have him empty his bladder every 2 to 3 hours, even if he doesn't necessarily feel he has to. Managing constipation is a really big thing, making sure he's having a bowel movement, you know, daily, at most every other day. And then limiting fluids before bed. And I'm sure you've probably been told all of this. And the desmopressin can help. You know, some of it is just, you know, some people advocate waking him up in the middle of the night to try and go. And Mike, the question would just be, you know, how much does it bother him? And would having him wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, would that be more bothersome to him than maybe waking up wet in the morning?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of standard stuff we've been, you know, in the last 6 years we've kind of done. And, you know, it's difficult, especially with the different medications that he's on. And, you know, you have rigidness in behavior. So, but, you know, I didn't know if there was anything else to kind of pursue. But, you know, it's a difficult problem. And he's not comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, some of it is going to have to do with you know, looking into the situation a little bit further. How much does his bladder hold? And there are some medications, some overactive bladder medications out there that you can take that can help him hold a little bit more at night.
What would that be? One of the issues that we found with urologists is that he doesn't empty all the way.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's another medication to possibly try, then I'd be interested to know what that is.
I'm a little bit hesitant just because I know that he's not emptying all the way to recommend a medication right off the bat. You know, it would really depend on how much he's leaving behind. You know, we'd kind of have to weigh that against how much he's... Okay. You know, so there are some overactive bladder medications, things like oxybutynin. There are a variety of medications within that class. There are other medications like mirbegron also that can help the bladder hold a little bit more. And, you know, I've had varying success with those. Sometimes it's just, you know, the bladder can only hold so much. And, you know, some people get better, some people don't. It's a little bit of trial and error.
Okay, Jeff, we're going to have to, a lot of people online. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. All right, let's go to Mike in Eastburn. Mike in Eastburn, you're on.
Hi there. I have a question on PSA levels. The last couple of doctor visits, my PSA has been creeping up. So I'm wondering, are there any supplements or dietary guidelines that may help control or stop the PSA level increase? My urologist said when I come back in October, if it's still going up, then he'll do a biopsy. I didn't know if there was anything I could do in the meantime.
Doctor, so why don't you just explain for those who are still not familiar with PSA what it is?
So PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen, and it's a blood test that you can do, and it's not specific for prostate cancer, but it is one of the possible markers of it. There are a number of things that cause the PSA level to go up, such as, from our previous caller, the prostatitis or infections. But prostate cancer is probably the main reason that we utilize it as a screening tool. And there are various recommendations that have been changed over the years from the U.S. Preventative Task Force on that. But in terms of your question, you know, the question isn't whether so much about the PSA number itself, because treating the number with any sort of herbal supplements, and I don't really know many herbal supplements that can change that, isn't so much the goal. It's really seeing it as a marker of any sort of possible need for intervention or a way to risk stratify someone in terms of whether or not they would need to have a biopsy to check for prostate cancer.
So in other words, you don't want to mask the PSA because the PSA could give you important information.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate your question.
Okay. Thanks for the show, Doctor.
Okay. Bye bye. All right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And now we're going to go to the very patient Jen in Washington County. Jen, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Bull. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a 60-year-old athlete, and my problem is more of a nuisance, but I'm experiencing stress incontinence when I'm running, down hills on trails. And sometimes, you know, crossing the finish line, if I put out a little too much effort, I might vomit, and holy cow, it's a problem. So any suggestions other than surgical?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as you were saying, stress incontinence. So that's the involuntary leakage of urine that's caused by exertion, as you were saying, when you're running or, you know, or when you're vomiting. Also, other things such as coughing, sneezing can cause that. And there are a variety of things that you can do, and it really depends on how much it bothers you and how aggressive you want to be about treating it. So there are things just in terms of behavioral therapy, making sure to empty your bladder at regular intervals, because I'm sure as you've experienced, the fuller your bladder is, the more likely you are to leak. There are other things like pelvic floor exercises that you can do either yourself or we can send you to a physical therapist who can work on those with you. And that's been found to be very effective as long as you keep on doing those pelvic exercises.
Pelvic exercises. Mm-hmm. Now, what are those?
You know, there are a lot in terms of types of pelvic exercise. There are a lot of them. For stress incontinence, you probably want to focus on strengthening your pelvic floor. There are some patients who actually need to work on relaxing their pelvic
floor. Could you describe one? Just describe one of what they...
So it would be like squeezing the pelvic floor as if you're trying to stop the urine from coming out. And you don't want to clench it, but you want to kind of like squeeze and relax.
Okay, so you're lying on your stomach?
Probably on your lap. I mean, on your back, sorry.
On your back, and now you're squeezing.
Mm-hmm. And you want to try and squeeze with the inside muscles. You know, make sure that... Your glute muscles, which are your butt muscles, are kind of just laying flat there. You don't want to use those. You don't want to use your stomach muscles. You really want to try and use just the muscles on the inside. And some people have a harder time accessing those, and that's when we do recommend you see a physical therapist who can work with you in accessing those. But that's
great. So there's local PTs who actually do that.
There are, yeah. There are some physical therapists out there, and that's what they specialize in. They're wonderful.
So if one were to call your office, they might be able to get that information?
Yeah. Usually what we would have you do is come in and see me, and I would assess you and talk to you about your options. But, yeah, I would be able to refer you to one of our wonderful physical therapists. There are other things.
Well,
there are pessaries, and there are inserts that are over the counter that you can get. And then, of course, there's surgery, as you said.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Now, what about all those people who feel whenever they wake up, they have to urinate? In other words, you sleep through the night, you got to pee in the morning. Or if you take an hour nap, you got to pee after the hour nap. What's that all about?
Oh, that's very common, especially as we get older. And, you know, in some people you can get what's called nocturia or nocturnal polyuria, where you're actually getting up at night. And that we kind of define it as more than twice a night. But a lot of people complain about having to wake up at night just to go. A lot of times that can be related to actually the way that your kidneys will regulate the fluid volume in your body. You can imagine if you're sleeping for 8 hours, more or less, most people will sleep through the night. However, if you think about during the day, most people aren't holding their urine for 8 hours at a time. So your kidneys actually have a way where they reabsorb a lot of that fluid that you would have put out at night. So, you know, my approach to people who are having nocturia or are getting up a lot at night is, first, you want to try and make sure that there's not something else going on, because a lot of times it can be reflective of, you know, your fluid balance or obstructive sleep apnea can cause that. Fluid in the legs, heart or kidney problems, and those are probably the first things that you want to try and make sure isn't going on. And then other than that, you know, there are some new medications that are out too to help with that. One was just FDA approved to help with some of the getting up at night.
Okay, we're going to go now to Helena in South Hadley. All right, Helena, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling because I heard the fellow talking about his son wetting the bed at night, and I had the same problem with my son, who also has an ASD condition, autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. And what we used was one of those pads that sets off an alarm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that, I mean, we tried a lot of other things, but that seemed to work.
Well, what is it now?
Because he wasn't waking. It's a pad, and you plug it in, and when it gets wet, it sets off an alarm, which wakes up the child. And, of course, the parents have to help him go to the bathroom because half the time he was half asleep. But it somehow trained him to associate the feeling with having to wake up.
Yeah, no, the bedwetting alarm is a good response that works with a lot of people.
Interesting.
One of my partners, Dr. Howe, over in my practice, does a lot of bedwetting, and he's actually pioneering some research studies looking at some other alternative therapies too, things like, I'm not going to speak for him, but there are things like different types of neuromodulation that he's trying. And, you know, there's a lot coming out of
neuromodulation.
Yeah. So, just different ways of, modulating or, the nerves that go to the bladder to try and change the bladder habits.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Right. Well, we tried the stuff that we were waking him up, and mm-hmm. It was just nothing was working, and somehow it's almost like his body had control.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad that helped for you.
Yeah. Okay. You know, it's worth a try because it's not that expensive.
Good advice. Thanks, Helena. Okay, well, let's go to Gail in Oneonta on line number 5. You're on.
Hi. Thank you. I'm wondering if there's any correlation between bladder spasms and incontinence, a mixed incontinence, and 74 years old female and overweight, but I've lost a lot of weight, and that hasn't seemed to change anything. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Gail. So I think I think it's important you brought up the idea of mixed incontinence. So mixed incontinence is when it's very common. It's when a person has the two most common types of incontinence, which would be stress incontinence and urge incontinence. So stress incontinence, we said before, that's leakage with exertion, coughing, sneezing, jumping, etc. And the urge incontinence, that's part of the overactive bladder symptom complex. So needing to run to the bathroom, having to go to the bathroom frequently, and then leaking on the way to the toilet. So definitely you can see, you know, you can see those bladder spasms with overactive bladder and that urge incontinence part of it. So yes, would be your answer.
So my question for you, Dr. Wolf, is you're a surgeon.
Yes.
Do you ever operate on to cure some of these incontinent problems?
I do. You know, probably the first thing that I do is just try and tease out what type of incontinence the patient has, what type of incontinence is most bothersome, and then try and address that. So, you know, the surgeries for the stress incontinence, there are a variety of them. Probably the gold standard would be a mid-urethral sling procedure. There are other things like coaptites, fascial sling procedures, and other different needle suspensions. And then for the urge incontinence, I usually take a stepped approach with that. You know, start with some behavioral modifications, cut out things like too much coffee, drinking too much water all the time, going to the bathroom on a regular schedule. You can do physical therapy either with yourself or a physical therapist. And then I usually will try at least 2 to 3 different medications. And then if that doesn't work, there actually are surgical treatments for that as well. Something like Botox works well for that. Also, things like a sacral nerve stimulators. We're talking about bladder modulations with the nerves. Or we can do an outpatient one called a posterior tibial nerve stimulation too.
The last one again, I didn't catch it.
Oh, sorry. Posterior tibial nerve stimulation.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Let's see here. Okay. Let's go to Andrea on line number 2. Okay. Andrea, your turn.
Hello. I'm calling for my brother who is visiting from Scotland. He has a 2-millimeter kidney stone, and in the last few days has been experiencing considerable pain. Two parts to my question. One, he's heard of a drug called Flomax. Would that be helpful to help him pass the stone? And the other part of the question is, he's thinking of going back to Scotland prematurely, and I just am concerned that a plane ride might not be a good thing.
Yeah, so Flomax, it's a medication. It's usually it's most commonly used for men who have BPH, so large prostates, to help them pass urine. But it is a relaxer of the smooth muscle in the urinary tract. So there's something called medical expulsive therapy that you can use Flomax for, and that's a way to kind of help you pass the kidney stone. And Flomax can help. In terms of whether or not it's safe for him to fly back to Scotland, I would definitely be careful. If he spikes fevers, is having nausea, vomiting, unable to keep fluids down, that's definitely something that he would need to address emergently.
Okay. Just quickly, just a quick last question is, about how long would it take to pass a 2-millimeter stone? I know it probably varies with people, but...
It's different for everybody. I would say probably anywhere from a couple days to a couple weeks.
Thank you very much, doctors.
Now, if they can't pass it, there are methodologies for breaking up the stone, aren't there?
There are, yes. So depending on the size, the composition, and the location of the stone, there are different types of surgical interventions, anywhere from like shockwave lithotripsy. Say that probably what I tend to do more commonly is I do ureteroscopy, which is taking a small camera, looking into the bladder and up the ureter, which is the urine tube that connects your kidney to your bladder, actually going up there, lasering the stone and taking the pieces out. For really, really large stones, you can actually go straight from the back into the kidney straight that way in something called a PCNL.
So how big is 2 centimeters?
It's small, but it doesn't feel small when you're passing a kidney stone.
What about relating it, for example, to an eraser on a pencil?
It is probably closer to like the little flecks that come off the eraser after you've erased something with it than
Oh, really?
The eraser itself.
Oh, okay.
Very good.
Let's see here. We have to get to a break, and then we'll be right back to talk to Mary and Bill and Kevin. And here we are with Dr. Jillian Wolf of Albany Medical Center, fellowship trained neurologic surgeon. And we just got a surgery question, so I thought I'd read it to you over the internet, or as Ray Graff always says, the interweb. 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer at the same time I started menopause. I'm 5 years cancer-free, but in a few years ago, my cervix dropped. This is exactly the kind of thing you were talking about, isn't it? And bulges out of my vagina. It does not happen all the time. So I was wondering what I can do non-surgically to help it stay in, for example, exercises. Or could you talk a little bit more about a pessary and how it works and its comfort and its use during sex also? Thank you for your time. Catherine.
So, yes. So in terms of non-surgical treatment, pelvic floor physical therapy and pelvic floor exercises can help to a degree. It depends how advanced the prolapse is. I would say that patients who have more advanced prolapse where it's hanging out a lot or almost all the way, I don't find the physical therapy to be quite as helpful. But if you have some of if it's not dropping quite as much, then that definitely can be helpful. And then pessaries, as I was saying before, there are these silicone devices that you can place into the vagina to help support things. And usually what we have people do is I have you come into the office and I examine you and I would fit you for a pessary. And they come in a variety of shapes and sizes. There are some pessaries that you can take in and out yourself and that you can have intercourse with. And then there are some types of pessaries that you can't. Usually the pessaries that I use for people who have more advanced prolapse are the ones that you would actually have to come to the office to have changed and cleaned.
But what about intercourse?
Intercourse, it would be difficult to have intercourse with those.
Yeah. So obviously the preference would be to use what?
Yeah, probably it's something that would be either like a ringed pessary or a ring with support pessary. And those it is possible to have intercourse with.
Okay. All right, good. Let's go to almost the same. Mary in Glens Falls. Okay, Mary in Glens Falls, you're on. Hello, Mary. Well, Mary, it's not coming through. We are so sorry. And we do apologize. Okay. So now we'll go to on line number six, Kevin. In Albany. Kevin, you're on.
Hello. Doctor, yes. I have had several cystoscopies and, you know, we found that I have an enlarged prostate that I've had for many years. And my urologist gave me Rapaflow. And the only significant side effect that I really have is I can have an orgasm, but I have no ejaculate. Will that come back, or is that going to be something that I will have to mourn? I'm 66 years old, and I'm not quite ready for that yet.
Yeah, so what you're describing is a common side effect of that class of medications. It's called retrograde ejaculation. So what the medication you're on does is it relaxes the smooth muscle around the bladder neck and in the prostatic urethra, making it easier to pass the urine. But what that does is that when you have an orgasm and when the ejaculate is deposited into the urethra, since the bladder neck is open, it allows the ejaculate actually to go up into the bladder, which isn't dangerous. You usually just urinate it out on your next void. But, you know, there are some other medications out there. They tend to do that as well. A surgical procedure for BPH tends to do that as well. I don't treat BPH quite as much as some of my colleagues. And
BPH, once again, is?
Benign prostatic hyperplasia.
Okay, go ahead.
There are some newer ways of some things like UroLift and that, and I'm just not as familiar with them. I would probably have to defer to them to see if retrograde ejaculation is a side effect of that. But it tends to often be with some of the treatments for BPH.
Now, there's no negative side to retrograde ejaculation?
I mean, you still are able to have an orgasm, and it doesn't put you at risk for any infection. You just lose that ejaculate coming out when you're having an orgasm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because that's what I was wondering where it went, and so now I know it can come out of my urine. Mm-hmm. There's another question I have. We found a bladder stone, but the doctor doesn't seem to be too worried about it. He's not going to, remove it or anything. Can he remove it, or is it something that I should be concerned with? Because I've talked to him about it several times every time we see it.
Yeah, you definitely can remove it. If it's causing symptoms, I would remove it.
I don't really have any problems or side effects or anything like that, and I think that's why he's saying, as opposed to going in and having surgery and taking it out.
Yeah, if it's not causing you problems like urinary tract infections, pain, or bleeding, you don't have to treat it. It's probably just a symptom that you're not voiding as well as you were hoping to.
Kevin, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
All right. 1-800-348-2551. We can get a couple more calls in if you want to get on. 1-800-348-2551. Pardon me. We'll go to Bill in Saratoga. Bill in Saratoga, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Wolf. Thanks very much for taking the call. Would you consider the use of allopathic treatment in augmentation of osteopathic treatment in augmentation of an allopathic treatment? As we know, the bladder is innervated by both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems. And if there's any impingement at L6, S1, S2, the neurologic dysfunction and thus the blood supply, the support of the ligaments. So what I'm suggesting is to approach it from both directions, simply because most of your callers today have non-resolved conditions.
Well, I think you're definitely correct that the nervous system is very important in bladder control and with the storage and the expulsion of urine. It's definitely something that I try and take into account in my treatment, especially for patients with no neurologic conditions, patients with MS or transverse myelitis or different spinal cord injuries or some born dysfunctions of the spinal cord. And there are some treatments that we have out there that specifically do address that. Different types of neuromodulation to it. I am an allopathic trained doctor, so I'm not quite as familiar as some of the osteopathic trained doctors.
Now, what does allopathic mean?
So two different approaches and two different main types of medical schools probably nowadays is that you have like a DO versus an MD.
Right.
So I'm an MD, so that's allopathic medicine. Right. Osteopathic medicine, which is DO, does look at like, I don't want to say anything wrong since I'm just not as familiar with it, but looking at like spinal alignment and things like that.
Well, they look at both the somatic and the visceral components of it. I mean, ptosis is very common in our society with the lack of abdominal core strength and transversus abdominis, our posture, our body mass index, that all tugs on those visceral organs. And once they've been stretched and once they go down, ptosis means a falling or dropping of organism of an organ. And a lot of your callers today have expressed that, especially with the prolapse situation. So I'm just suggesting that it would make a good marriage or a good communication. I'm not saying that we should abandon our medical treatment at all, but no. I'm just saying it may support it.
Yeah, that sounds like a very nice suggestion. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Nick is next. Nick, you're on.
Yes. Hello, doctor.
Hello.
In March, I was had an attack of my nervous system, and it was due to an previous implant. They were unable to do an MRI, so they evaluated that transverse myelitis was the diagnosis.
Okay.
And I've had ongoing bladder issues since then. It takes about three times to void, and I had about three UTIs back-to-back after being discharged from the hospital.
Now, UTI is urinary tract infection, is that
yes.
what it is?
Yeah,
okay,
yes,
go ahead.
Yes. Because of the transverse myelitis, it actually impacts my walking,
mm-hmm.
Which I've been fortunate enough to regain some. But I am seeing a urologist, and they have me on finasteride and temsulosin.
Mm-hmm.
How do they do with that? And they're telling me to wait it out. As you said, the nighttime is a nightmare because of that. But should I seek another doctor for a second opinion, or should I?
I encourage my own patients, if you have any questions or feel that they're unanswered, there's no problems with asking for a second opinion. I think you're touching on an important topic about neurogenic bladder, that anyone who has a neurologic problem, especially those of the spinal cord, it can impact the bladder. There is a cooling off period that you do need to go to, where you kind of have more of like a shock phase to your bladder from like this into the nerves from the transverse myelitis. But after that, I would probably, you know, reassess. There are different studies we can do to look at whether this is a bladder storage problem or the bladder squeezing when it's not supposed to, and then really direct our treatments to what exactly is going on with you.
Okay, Nick, thank you. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And now over to Bill in Lake George. Bill, you're on.
Hi, doctor. What should I look for in selecting a urologist to operate on a hydrocele?
You know, before you go ahead, just tell us what a hydrocele is, doctor.
So a hydrocele, that's swelling down in the scrotal sac that's separate from the testicle. And it has to do with some just fluid building up there. And, you know, a lot of people have hydroceles. Some people, they can get considerably larger. And once it gets to a size where it really, you know, bothers you, either it's difficult to wear underwear, or it's a heavy feeling, then that would be a reason to operate on the hydrocele. You actually need to take out the tissues that are enclosing the hydrocele. You can't just simply drain it. It will come back. In terms of selecting a urologist, you know, you can always ask your primary care physician who they would recommend. I would look for somebody that, you know, takes your insurance and that you get along with. I think it's always important to meet your surgeon beforehand. And make sure that they can explain things to you in a way that you can understand, and that you have a chance to ask questions, and that you feel comfortable, you know, being in their hands.
Is there anything that can be done to delay progression? Anything you should do or not do?
Not that I'm really that aware of. Making sure that you're comfortable, and sometimes wearing tighter fitting underwear or elevating the scrotum, that can help as well, just in terms of like some of the discomfort.
Okay, thank you very much. While we're on the subject, you know, an awful lot of people buy medications that give them erections, obviously. Mm-hmm. Is there a danger in all of that?
They're relatively safe, you know, that you
don't they raise blood pressure or something like that?
In people who have heart conditions, where they're not healthy enough to be having intercourse, that can be an issue. If you're on certain types of medications like nitrates for your heart, then those are two things that you probably wouldn't want to mix, because it can actually make your blood pressure decrease quite a bit. And then, you know, other side effects that you always hear about and people kind of giggle about on TV, about the erection lasting for too long. But
4 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's.
Then you would definitely need to consult a doctor for
that's
that.
Well, that's what they say, but I think it's a brag to tell you that you take this medication.
It's usually not so, it's not comfortable.
Okay.
And it can lead to long-term issues.
We'll go to Dina in Greenfield. Dina in Greenfield, you're on.
Hello, doctor.
Hi there, Dina. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you. My questions go to, I have a full uterine prolapse, so it's outside of the body by several inches. And I've been assessed by a PT a couple of years back, mm-hmm. who determined that my muscles were very weak. We did do the exercises, but she didn't have much hope for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a couple questions. Number one, this leaves me probably a candidate for surgery. But with the muscles being so weak, does that still allow for the type of surgery where they pull the muscles together? Or am I stuck with a mesh? And what are the possibilities of repositioning manually for sexual intercourse?
So, you know, there are different types of surgeries that you can do for prolapse. Mainly, I kind of separate them into vaginal repairs versus abdominal repairs of prolapse. And then there's also reconstructive procedures and obliterative procedures. So the vaginal repairs, where we would actually surgically, we'd probably do a hysterectomy. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And then
I'm sorry to interrupt, but a hysterectomy is the removal of the
uterus. And if in that case, if I was doing a vaginal repair, it would be the cervix and the uterus and the fallopian tubes. And then when we do vaginal surgery, we tend, especially on first-time repairs, we do what's called a native tissue repair, where we actually use your own tissue to reconstruct.
Right.
And then, as opposed to an abdominal repair, which is something that we often do with the robot, where you do a mesh. And I know there's a lot of there's a lot of talk out there about mesh for prolapse. If you look
now,
at
what is the mesh? Where is the? I know where a mesh goes in a hernia. Where does a mesh go in this case?
So it depends on the type of mesh that you're talking about. You know, when you know the commercials and the FDA communications about vaginal mesh for prolapse really refer to mesh that's placed through the vagina for prolapse repair, not for incontinence. That's a different thing. But and it's also different from the mesh that you put in through the abdomen for prolapse repair. You know, it's very complicated, kind of all these different things. But in terms of what studies have shown is that for a vaginal repair of prolapse for the first time, that we tend to see very similar outcomes in terms of patients' complaints, whether or not you use a mesh. So
the alternative to using a mesh, I'm sorry for interrupting,
would just be using someone's own tissue to reconstruct.
I see. Okay, great.
You know, in certain people's hands and in certain patients, it's still an option. I tend not to do transvaginal mesh for prolapse. And I don't know, you can't see me, but I'm younger, so I kind of came up in.
So where do you get it from? Where do you get the...
They're made by different companies.
Well, the mesh, I guess.
The mesh, yes.
But what about the other stuff? Where do you take it from? Where you're taking your
It depends on the exact type of surgery that we're talking about. There are different ligaments that you can attach the top of the vagina to, or different tissues within the vagina that you can sew. And then we were saying the robotic repair. I do use a mesh for the robotic repair. That it's called a sacrocolpopexy. And if you do look at the FDA communications, it does explicitly state that the complication rates for the meshes that you use transabdominally as opposed to through the vagina are much, much lower and are in the acceptable range as opposed to the transvaginal mesh in some cases. So I'm sorry, your original question was your ability to have intercourse. Yeah, so as long as you aren't doing an obliterative procedure, something where you're actually closing the vagina, you really should be able to have intercourse. And if you're opposed to the mesh, there are definitely some non-mesh repairs that you can do.
Okay, listen, we're going to have to leave it at that. We're out of time. Thank you very much for
the
call.
Thank you.
Very interesting. All right. Dr. Jillian Wolf of Albany Medical Center, fellowship-trained urologic surgeon who provides care to both men and women. Dr. Wolf, we love having you here, and we invite you back. Come anytime.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Love to have you. So that's the program for today. And we thank everybody. Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our engineer, Jordan Taylor. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.